This is the first time I can think of in which a major Hollywood star has played a central character who is gay, and his homosexuality is completely irrelevant.
This one is called The Night Listener.
Tell me, how does it feel? You're just in love with a boy from the dark side of town. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Slovenia's same-gender couples win out-of-sight recognition, a Maupin Williams movie mystery questions reality, and freaks, roots, and pop rock from the audiophile. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 29, 2006. The Baltic nation of Slovenia has granted legal recognition to registered same-gender partners, but with significant restrictions. The new law gives gay and lesbian couples access to each other's pensions and property, but inexplicably limits those at the official ceremonies to the couple and a local registry official. Slovenia's gay and lesbian organizations, while welcoming the move, criticize the law as insufficient because no friends or family can attend the ceremonies, and they may only be conducted in a state office. Lesbian and gay couples must register 30 days in advance and provide documents proving they are sane, healthy, and unmarried. In early July, the Czech Republic became the first country in the region to legalize much less restrictive gay and lesbian civil partnerships.
But Washington's Supreme Court this week dealt U.S. marriage equality advocates another setback. The state legislature passed its version of the Defense of Marriage Act in 1998, restricting marriage to one man and one woman. Two lawsuits were filed by a total of 19 gay and lesbian couples challenging the constitutionality of the law. Overturning lower court decisions in each of those cases, the Washington High Court ruled 5-4 that only the legislature could change the state's marriage laws. In his concurring opinion, Justice James Johnson wrote that the challenge by marriage equality backers involved a claim of raw judicial power to redefine public institutions such as marriage. This court does not possess that power. No court does. The majority opinion also echoed recent rulings by other state high courts that bearing and raising children is an important reason to keep marriage an exclusively heterosexual institution. But the main dissenting opinion, written by Justice Mary Fairhurst, criticized her colleagues for ignoring the fact that denying same-sex couples the right to marry has no prospect of furthering any of those interests. Nor have any of the recent high court rulings citing the state's need to encourage heterosexual matrimony, most notably in New York and Georgia, acknowledged the existence of thousands of same-gender couples and their children. The narrow 5-4 decision, issued 16 months after the court heard oral arguments, generated pages of competing opinions. Because only three justices agreed with the specific rationale of the ruling, it's a plurality opinion given less weight than if a full majority had signed on. Two other justices agreed that the state's Defense of Marriage Act was constitutional, but issued separate opinions to explain their reasoning. Even the majority ruling acknowledged the discrimination faced by same-gender couples and said that the legislature should address those inequities. Openly gay Washington State Representative Jim Moeller vowed this week to do just that, saying he'll introduce a bill in the next legislative session to open marriage to same-gender couples. The Democrat-controlled California legislature last year became the only U.S. state lawmaking body to pass a marriage equality bill, but Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed it.
The next judicial walk down the matrimonial aisle appears to be in Maryland's highest court. A Baltimore circuit judge ruled in January that the state's ban on same-gender marriage is unconstitutional. The Maryland Court of Appeals agreed this week to fast-track to its next term a constitutional challenge to the law, originally filed by the American Civil Liberties Union and Equality Maryland on behalf of 9 same-gender couples. Oral arguments before the Court of Appeals are expected to be heard in December. No one would predict when the Maryland High Court might issue a ruling.
Lambda Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union announced this week that they filed papers asking the full federal 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to reconsider its 3-judge panel's decision upholding a particularly onerous Nebraska statute. The July 14th ruling said that the voter-approved state constitutional amendment banning any form of legal recognition for lesbian and gay couples does not violate the U.S. Constitution. There were no predictions as to if, when, or how the Eighth Circuit would respond to the appeal.
A challenge to the notion that marriage equality should be the priority issue for queer advocacy groups is being widely circulated and discussed across America. A statement titled Beyond Same-Sex Marriage, A New Strategic Vision for All Our Families and Relationships, asserts that advocacy for other important issues affecting gays and lesbians has been overwhelmed by the time and dollars spent on marriage equality and ignores many in the community for whom marriage is not a direct concern. Among the 250 original signatories are current and former leaders of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, novelist Armistead Maupin, and heterosexual allies like scholar Cornel West, Ms. Magazine founder Gloria Steinem, and essayist Barbara Ehrenreich. The timing of its release, during the same week that the task force, GLAAD, and Freedom to Marry launched a $250,000 nationwide Marriage Matters newspaper ad campaign, was coincidental, according to Joseph DeFilippis of Queers for Economic Justice and a co-author of the statement. He told reporters that resources spent on marriage dwarf what's spent on other important issues, such as domestic partnership and universal health care. But Lambda Legal's John Davidson said he doubted that the circulating statement would create a serious divide in the LGBT community. "I think the press attention is definitely focused disproportionately on marriage," he said, "but most organizations and many members of our community are not." DeFilippis claimed that the number of signatories at beyondmarriage.org more than doubled in the first week it was posted, suggesting growing support for a greater advocacy on a wider slate of LGBT issues.
With the backing of the Service Members Legal Defense Network, a decorated Army sergeant and Arabic language specialist is speaking out about his discharge under the infamous Don't Ask, Don't Tell U.S. military policy. 30-year-old Blue Kopas told the Associated Press this week that he was outed earlier this year by several anonymous emails to his superiors in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Kopas says his honorable discharge papers, which mention his awards and citations, also give the reason for his dismissal, outing him to prospective employers before they've even had the chance to meet him. He plans to appeal to the Army Board for Correction of Military Records. More than 11,000 lesbian and gay service members have been dismissed under Don't Ask, Don't Tell since its inception in 1993. The Federal General Accountability Office reported that nearly 800 of them have had critical skills, including 300 linguists. 55 were proficient in Arabic, including Kopas, a graduate of the Defense Language Institute. According to the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military at the University of California, Santa Barbara, discharging and replacing those service members has cost the Pentagon nearly $369 million.
A federal judge this week dismissed a challenge to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy brought by a veteran Air Force nurse who was forced out of her job because she's a lesbian. Air Force Reserve Major Margaret Witt of Spokane, Washington, asked U.S. District Judge Ronald B. Layton to reinstate her, citing the 2003 U.S. Supreme Court ruling striking down all state sodomy laws. Layton ruled that the decision didn't affect the constitutionality of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Witt is a 19-year Air Force veteran who'd been assigned to a medical evacuation squadron working out of McChord Air Force Base near Tacoma. She was suspended without pay in late 2004 after the Air Force received an apparently anonymous tip that she had been in a long-term relationship with a civilian woman. Her official discharge is still pending. Doug Honig of the American Civil Liberties Union said they plan to appeal Witt's case to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. "Major Witt is much decorated and has saved people's lives," he told reporters. "The people she helped didn't care about her sexual orientation."
It apparently requires other than U.S. citizenship and knighthood to overcome the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. British gay actor and outspoken activist Sir Ian McKellen has been made an officer in the Georgia National Guard by Republican Governor Sonny Perdue. Although Perdue supports the anti-queer military policy and has been an outspoken opponent of marriage equality, his staff was apparently ignorant of McKellen's sexual orientation. "I was in Atlanta doing press for the Da Vinci Code, and they wanted to honor me," Sir Ian told the New York Daily News, boasting, "The governor made me a lieutenant colonel."
And finally, unless you've been sequestered somewhere, you probably know that a boy band heartthrob has said bye 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 to the closet in a big way. Lance Bass of the hit-making NSYNC came out in a splashy cover story this week in People magazine. The singer said he's been reluctant to be more open about his sexual orientation because he feared it might affect the success of NSYNC, which has been on hiatus since 2003, and that he felt responsible for the careers of his bandmates as well as his own. Bass says he's in a very stable relationship with Ryken Lemkuhl, a co-winner of the CBS TV reality show The Amazing Race a few seasons back. "The thing is, I'm not ashamed. That's the one thing I want to say," he told the magazine. "I'm more liberated and happy than I've been my whole life." Bye, bye, bye.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 29th, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
Some stark musical messages from the Underdogs will last till the end of time. But you won't have to wait that long to hear them, just until a bit later in this program. The Night Listener is a movie thriller based on the novel by Armistead Maupin. His book was in turn based on the true story of a story that was not true. With preview clips, This Way Out's Steve Pride sorts the facts from the factitious with Maupin and star Robin Williams.
From the studios of WNYH in New York City, I'm Gabriel Noon, and this is Noon at Night. As a storyteller, I've spent years looting my life for fiction. Like a magpie, I tend to steal the shiny stuff and discard the rest. The facts can always be altered when you're telling a story, but this time, I have to be careful. I'll lay out the events exactly as I remember them. I want you to believe this, after all. That'll be hard enough as it is. This one is called The Night Listener.
Based on the book by Armistead Maupin and starring Robin Williams, The Night Listener is a psychological thriller that revolves around a popular writer and late-night radio show host, Gabriel Noon. Numbed by a breakup with his lover, Jess, Gabriel develops an intense phone relationship with a young listener named Pete, who has written a harrowing memoir about sexual abuse and his battle with AIDS. But when troubling questions arise regarding the boy's identity, Gabriel must overcome his depression and set out on a journey to find the truth. The movie is based on the book. The book is based on a true story, sort of.
Back in 1992, I was sent the manuscript of a memoir written by a 14-year-old boy who had suffered terrible abuse at the hands of his parents.
Author Armistead Maupin.
He'd been sort of sold into sex slavery. And had been rescued by a social worker, had run away from home, and the social worker rescued him, and she recognized him as this bright, intelligent soul. She encouraged him to start writing. In fact, Paul Manette, my friend down in Los Angeles, who died of AIDS about 10 years ago, was the first person to coax him to write. And the memoir was sent to me, and I struck up a phone friendship with him the same way Paul had, and was very impressed by his feistiness and his courage, and I believed at the time that he was going to be dying within a year, and so I tried to be as supportive as I could be when he would call, and then a sort of very natural friendship grew up out of it. It was like knowing someone really special. And it wasn't until 6 months into the relationship that Terry Anderson, who was my partner then, listened to the mother on the phone, the woman who had adopted the boy, and pointed out that their voices sounded strangely similar. And that thrust me into a mystery that I was living day to day. For 6 years, really, I had to split my head down the middle, halfway believing in this person, but preparing for the possibility that he might not be real.
Whether or not the boy was real or lived only in the imagination of an adult impostor, the book, A Rock in a Hard Place, One Boy's Triumphant Story, was published in 1993.
Paul Manette wrote the preface to A Rock in a Hard Place, and that book was written by Anthony Godby Johnson, who was the kid I was talking to. The afterword, by the way, was written by Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. So it came to me with the best possible credentials. I had really no reason to doubt it. When I called the publisher in New York, he said, "Hang on a second, I have to close the door." And when I expressed my doubts, I said, do you know anybody who's actually met him? He told me that he'd been through the same doubts himself, but that he was convinced of his existence. His words were, he's like God, he's someone you have to believe in. Well, I'm not someone who has to believe in God. I can find my God in other places. I was thrown into, you know, terrible doubt, really, about as to what the truth was. And I realized that the only way I could dig myself out of this mess was to write about it in a fictional way and examine it in that way. My partner, Terry Anderson, my ex-partner, Terry Anderson, a few years back discovered there was an actual pathology called factitious disorder, in which people invent illnesses for themselves or for a child in order to gain sympathy. I don't know whether that's what happened in my instance, because I couldn't begin to play shrink here, but it seems like a logical explanation. I can't just sort of shrug this off with a laugh and say, oh, another trick played on the literary establishment, the way a lot of people did when J.T. Leroy was exposed as an invention, because this person actually spent hours on the phone feigning a near-death child who was about to die and draining the energy of, for instance, Paul Manette, who was close to death himself. And eventually had to just say, please don't call me anymore, because he wasn't certain himself as to who this was on the phone, and he had to think about his own death.
The Night Listener stars Robin Williams, a longtime friend of Armistead Maupin.
Armistead Maupin sent me a copy of the script saying, this piece is based upon my novella. And he sent me a copy saying, I think you'd like it. And he said, I think it's a great character. And not really, you know, saying it's me, but, you know. And I read it and went, oh, it is very good, thank you. I mean, he just wanted me to read it to see if I could, or like, just see what happens. And it was fascinating. From the very first, I was like, it's a great piece, and wanted to be part of it. And for me, it kind of bookends 1 hour photo in terms of being on the receiving end of that type of disturbed personality. Reading his novella, combined with knowing Armistead for 30 years, gives you a nice running start. And then the idea of, you know, extrapolating from that, and in the past having strange people contact you, and people who will be very nice with you in the moment. If you deny what they say, they get, you know, like Tony, very kind of, they flip on you. And all of a sudden it's like, I didn't mean to scare you. And it's like, if you don't say exactly what they want to hear, it can be quite scary.
In The Night Listener, Gabriel Noon's boyfriend, Jess, has just left him, paralleling Armistead Maupin's own separation from his lover, Terry Anderson. Jess is played by Will and Grace alumnus, Bobby Cannavale.
If you're going to have a boyfriend, that's a good one. You know, it's kind of like a younger De Niro, but, you know, and a good kisser. Hey, what can I say? Sexy guy, you know? It was my version of Brokeback Mountain. That's as close as I can go right now. Bobby, you know, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. So I'm talking like Bob. It's a good thing.
So what does Armistead Maupin want the audience to take away from the film version of his novel?
I'm very proud of the fact, among other things, that this is the first time I can think of in which a major Hollywood star has played a central character who is gay, and his homosexuality is completely irrelevant. It's simply part of his identity. There may be exceptions. I've been trying to think of what they are, but I'm happy that we accomplished that. And I mostly want people to have a good time. I want them to be thrilled. I want them to understand how you can go to see a movie and be creeped out by it and be sitting on the edge of your seat without having to have a lot of loud noises and quick cuts and dismembered limbs.
And in the end, I'm not sure what really happened, but it is clear that Donna and I are more alike than not. Both of us afraid, not wanting to be alone, longing for a good listener. As for Pete, there's a line in The Velveteen Rabbit that reads, real isn't how you're made, it's the thing that happens to you. I'm Gabriel Noon. Good night.
This has been a conversation with author Armistead Maupin and actor Robin Williams. The Night Listener is a Miramax release starring Robin Williams, Tony Collette, Bobby Cannavale, Rory Culkin, and Sandra Oh. As always, you can find more info at prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Transamerica, Capote, Brokeback Mountain, and others made 2005 a memorable year for queer content movies. Hear copious clips and comments by the filmmakers in Steve Fried's wonderful half-hour review. Log on to thiswayout.org to find out how you can own Pride on Screen 2005 and help keep this program on the air.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of The Night Listener, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine.
Queer.
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 Radio.
A lesbian outsider, an independent New Englander, and a dynamic duo star in this month's edition of The Audiophile.
Second grade, Billy Sims, playing out by the jungle gym. All the boys laughed at him for some sort of speech impediment. And they knocked him down. And I pushed them off. And they kicked our asses, 'cause we Underdogs.
That song is called The Underdogs, and last month it won the Out Music Award for Out Song of the Year. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. The Underdogs is also the title of this latest album by Jen Foster.
Well, my new CD is called The Underdogs, and I wrote it as a tribute to the freaks that I grew up with, myself included, of course. I think the tone of the record is a bit dark and contemplative, but I always have a message of hope in my song. I really wanted to reach out to the outsider in all of us, I guess, and remind people that everyone has a place in the world.
Find out more about Jen Foster and her album The Underdogs at www.jenfoster.com.
The fifth album for Vermont native Gregory Douglas is called Stark.
A tragedy is the bottom of the mind's eye, but nobody replies or asks the right questions. It tells the right lies. Tragedy is the bottom of the mind's eye, and nobody really tries, and nothing's in motion. You think you do it all, but you're just in love with the boy from the dark side of town, 'cause he's always around. It's just a matter of circumstance, not so wrong.
The new album, Stark, is my fifth independent release, and it is a lot more stripped down than all the other records, hence the name Stark. I really wanted to get a lot more towards my roots, people that inspired me, and it's a lot more of an emotional, confrontational album in general.
If I have the time, can I cry on your shoulder? In my head, I have nothing to blame but myself. Still, it's always the same in your feeling down. You always break down. So if you see the sunshine under the landslide, I'll be waiting for a sign to wake up. And if you see the sunshine over the rainbow, I'll be waiting for a better tomorrow.
You can learn more about the album Stark at www.gregorydouglas.com. and Douglas is D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S.
The latest album from pop duo Jason and DeMarco is called Till the End of Time.
I see it every day in me, a tendency to get so lost. That's why I need someone like you to bring me home. There is no doubt in my mind that God has brought to me an answered prayer.
Their last album was called Spirit Pop, and Jason explains their new direction.
We're wanting to go in a direction of reaching even a broader audience. It's definitely more mainstream, leaning more towards a pop rock sound. We want to still have positive lyrics throughout the music, but it's more about real life. It's real life, real relationships, and then also bringing elements of spirituality into it.
But the weather girl, what the hell does she know? It's cloudy. It smells like rain. Where the hell do we go? It's cloudy now. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray.
Find out more about Jason and DeMarco's album, Till the End of Time, at www.jasonanddemarco.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 66648, Houston, Texas, 77006, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trenton. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Christopher Gall, Tanya Kane Perry, Rex Walkner, Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Steve Pride, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out exclusively at outinamerica.com. Click on the features link on their front page or use the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air and choose from some special LGBT movie, music, and history CDs as our thanks. To sign up for our weekly email program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WERU Bangor and Blue Hill Falls, Maine, CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba, KUNR Reno, Nevada, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.